Saskatchewan potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Vice, Destroyer, On the Basis of Sex, Stan and Ollie, and Holmes and Watson. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Starman, a new anniversary edition out on Blu-ray. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can also reach me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Even though movies are out there in the theaters, there's really nothing happening in entertainment right now. They've taken a break. I mean, the entertainment industry is more shut off now than the government is at this point. So we're in that little lull period where everybody's on vacation, and nobody's doing anything. So I'm going to take that time to announce my top three movies of the year. I only do three because, you know, it's a radio show. I don't want to do 10. That would be kind of overkill. My number three movie of the year.
An outbreak of dog flu rips through the city of Megasaki. Trash Island becomes an exile colony. Nobody's giving up around here, and don't you forget it, ever. We're a pack of scary, indestructible alpha dogs.
Atari Kobayashi, you heroically hijacked a junior turboprop XJ-750 and flew it to the island because of your dog.
Darn it.
I've got a crush on you.
Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs. This is one that a lot of people have forgotten. I think a lot of it is because it came out like in March or April, depending. I think it was a limited release. Now, there have been Wes Anderson movies that have done better over the course of the year, like the Grand Budapest Hotel, I think was like a springtime movie that ended up winning a whole bunch of Best Picture awards. And this one didn't get as much love. I think that there was, it was a softer movie, but I love Wes Anderson's stuff. And I thought it was culturally interesting because he took certain elements of Japanese culture. And in this movie, it's a stop motion animation film, sort of like what he did with Fantastic Mr. Fox. But it's something a little bit different. I think there was some American audience had trouble digesting it. But I have to say, it's still a brilliant piece of artistry and something unlike anything you've actually seen in the theaters this year or kind of any other year. So Isle of Dogs is a forgotten one, but it is my number three movie of the year. The next one I want to put on my list for number two movie of the year, and that is another piece of animation.
My name is Miles Morales. I'm the one and only Spider-Man. At least that's what I thought.
You ever hear of the Super Collider? You're gonna love this.
Dimension opening now.
You're like me.
That's impossible.
We need to get back to our universes soon.
Brooklyn is gonna collapse. My family lives in Brooklyn.
This was never your city. It's mine.
If I don't destroy the collider, none of us will have a home to go home to.
That's right. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Every year, there seems to be a movie that comes up that I don't see until like the last couple weeks of the year. And then I see it and I absolutely love it. This one rocketed to the top of my list in a year that superhero movies have really cleaned up at the box office. I mean, if you look at like the top grossing movies of 2018, you've got Avengers, Infinity War, and Black Panther. They trade number one spots, whether you're talking about domestic or international gross. But Black Panther's number one domestically, but also Infinity War, Incredibles 2, Deadpool 2. I mean, the top five, with the exception of Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom, all the rest are superhero movies, and there's a whole bunch in there, and I wouldn't be surprised if Aquaman starts squirting into the top 10 by the time all those numbers are run. But Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is so unique and so different, and it so adapts the look and the culture and the feel of a comic book. It is such a brilliantly done movie, and it's literally the best Spider-Man movie I've seen in a decade, at least. I mean, I love Spider-Man in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I also love this very authentic feeling multi-universe element of Spider-Man. And that's why I love that one so much. But that's not my number one. My number one movie of this year is another one that came out kind of early. And it's Spike Lee's latest.
There's never been a black cop in this city. We think you might be the man to open things up around here.
Well, who am I speaking with?
This is David Duke.
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
The KKK is planning an attack.
How do you propose to make this investigation?
We'll establish contact over the phone.
We'll need a white officer to play me when they meet face to face.
So there becomes a combined
Ron Stallworth.
Can you do that?
With the right white man, we can do anything.
Black Klansman. Now, I'm not a big fan of Spike Lee. I blow hot and cold with his stuff. I think some of his movies are fantastic. I think Malcolm X was an epic movie. It has some problem parts to it, but it's a really good movie. I'm not as much sold on Do the Right Thing, which I know everybody loved, but, you know, I think his stuff goes hot and cold. I mean, he's done some real crap like that, The Sweet Blood of Jesus, that crowdfunded piece he did, but Black Klansman is so well done. It is so unbelievable in terms of the setup of the story. Now, there's other contrived stuff that goes on there, but it's very relevant to stuff that's happening today in terms of race relations and what seems to be a little bit of a surge of white supremacy in this country. It shows some very relevant things in this movie. So Black Klansman, that's my number one pick of the movies for 2018. Now, a couple honorable mentions. I do want to give a little bit of love to a couple movies that nobody seems to mention in their list. Suspiria, I thought, was brilliantly done and a very worthy remake. Unsane, Steven Soderbergh's film about a woman stuck in an insane asylum, kind of against her will. That's creepy as all get out. And then Paddington 2, because that came out almost an entire year ago. And then, of course, a little bit of nod to best performances. I thought Emily Blunt was fantastic in Mary Poppins Returns, really encapsulated Julie Andrews. Tilda Swinton was amazing in Suspiria because she plays multiple roles, but you wouldn't even recognize her in some of them. And then finally, Christian Bale in Vice. We'll be talking about that movie a little bit later in the show, but there's a little bit of a spoiler. He's amazing in terms of his chameleon performance. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to hit in the trailers is The Kid That Would Be King, and it opens just in a couple weeks on January 25th.
Beres, you've got to see what I found.
There's something written on the card. Put it into Google Translate.
It means Sword of Arthur.
What if you're the only person who could have pulled that sword out? What if it's
Excalibur?
Ah, finally. Follow me.
I am Merlin.
In 4 days, the dark sorcerer Morgana will take over the world.
Awaken my warriors.
And I'm supposed to stop her. That's ridiculous.
After Harry Potter made it big in the movies, there were all these films that they tried to redo. And I talked about that one when The Mortal Engines came out a couple weeks ago. This one feels like it would have been one of those, but it's been far enough from the Harry Potter movies that it doesn't seem to be drawing from that. It just seems to be telling this cool little story about a King Arthur legend. And I actually think that looks kind of cool. I'm looking forward to this one. This one actually really has captured my attention because, I mean, it's going to be for kids, but that's okay. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Us, which is Jordan Peele's follow-up to Get Out, opens on March 15th.
What are you people?
It's us.
They look exactly like us. They think like us. They know where we are. We need to move and keep moving.
They won't stop until they kill us. Or we kill them.
One of the biggest worries that I think a lot of people have with Jordan Peele is that his follow-up to Get Out isn't going to be as good. I have to say that Us looks creepy as all Get Out. It does look like it encapsulates elements of horror, and I don't know if it's going to be doing the sort of like the deconstruction of race relations in America as much as like Get Out did, but this certainly looks like an intriguing movie with plenty of layers, so this is another one I'll definitely be looking forward to come March. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about On the Basis of Sex and Holmes and Watson. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the proper movie reviews. Now, I know a lot of these are not opening everywhere, and I'm on the radio all over the country, so it's very hard to pin down the release dates on some of these movies. Sometimes they don't even show them to me. The reason I have the privilege to see these movies early now, right as we're in that last week of the year, they don't do any screenings between Christmas and New Year's. They just, like I said, it all takes off at this point. Part of it is they send me, the studios send me screening discs for award consideration. And I've seen a bunch of these movies because of that. And so I can bank them early. And that's very helpful to me. But of course, you may not be able to see these yet. These may not even open until sometime in January in your local markets. But I figure it's worth talking about. The first one is On the Basis of Sex. Felicity Jones stars as a young Ruth Bader Ginsburg as she argues one of her first major cases involving sexual discrimination and gender rights.
I want to represent clients in pursuit of justice.
So they're going to give you a corner office?
I wasn't what they were looking for. One said women are too emotional to be lawyers. Another told me a woman graduating top of her class must be a real ball buster. I worked hard. I did everything I was supposed to, and I excelled.
If the law differentiates on the basis of sex, then how will women and men ever become equals?
I don't read tax court cases.
Read this one.
They could topple the whole damn system of discrimination.
I do find movies that come out later in the year, there always seem to be one or two that feels like it's a, sort of like at least a spiritual connection to another movie that had come out earlier in the year. I mean, like this year, you had Beautiful Boy and Ben is Back. Both of those movies were about addiction in a child and having to deal with that. So those things felt like they had a lot of connective tissue. On the Basis of Sex feels really close to the movie Marshall that came out last year, which was a look at Thurgood Marshall, who, of course, was a Supreme Court justice. He was the first Black Supreme Court justice, and he also had a history of civil rights defense, and that was his first, one of his first big cases. And this is sort of feels the same way, because even though Ruth Bader Ginsburg wasn't the first woman on the Supreme Court, she certainly is an iconic image. And it's the second Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie that's come out this year, because they had that RBG documentary that came out earlier this year from Magnolia. But this one stars Felicity Jones, who's way more attractive than Ruth Bader Ginsburg ever was. I mean, that's not a knock against Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She wasn't a bad-looking lady when she was younger. I mean, she's in her 80s now, so you should get the bun and the glasses. But, I mean, Felicity Jones is adorable, and RBG, she's always kind of had that sort of that New York edge to her, which, I mean, Felicity, I have a huge thing for Felicity Jones, if you haven't noticed, so nothing against Ginsburg, much respect for your career and your position on the court, but yeah, Felicity Jones, just there's a special piece of my heart for her, but going to the story, this doesn't tell the story of her as a judge or on the bench. This tells the story of when she's trying to really just kind of break into the field of law and the obstacles she ran into, of course, in the late 60s and into the 70s. And what I found most interesting is I live in a world, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, but by the time I became an adult, it was pretty much the 90s, and a lot of had changed. I mean, by the 90s, for example, Sandra Day O'Connor was already on the court of the Supreme Court. So it wasn't an unheard of thing having women as lawyers and women in positions of judgeship. I served on a jury in 2005, and there was a female judge there. She ended up becoming, I believe, the Secretary of State of Ohio. But that seems a rather normal thing. But then I realized, yeah, back in the 60s and even the early 70s, there was a lot to overcome in terms of the sexual revolution. And I think the most interesting thing about this movie is it's well performed and it's pretty well directed. I mean, it tells a story about how she develops this case to really kind of blow up gender discrimination in America, at least from a legal perspective, from through the courts. And that was certainly a good thing. But what I found so fascinating about this is the historical context of stuff that I was alive during, even though I was a little kid pooping my pants and because I was just a toddler at the time. And don't worry, it was not last week that was happening. But you look at this movie and you say these were laws that were on the books that were really pretty horrifying gender discrimination laws. Stuff like you can't get a credit card without your husband's name. Or you can't work overtime, or there are certain jobs you legally are not allowed to have. And that is something that seems so foreign to us now, but really just within the last 40, 50 years. Those are real laws on the books, and it kind of puts you back in the present. If you talk about like social change, and that's what I found so interesting about this movie. You know, 100 years ago, women couldn't vote in this country. And you say, yeah, 100 years is 100 years, but 100 years isn't really that long ago. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, 300, 400, 500, you know, many generations. I mean, 100 years ago, women couldn't vote. 150 years ago, slavery was just outlawed in this country. So, I mean, it shows how much things can change very fast. And I think that puts certain amounts of social change, especially contemporary social change, in perspective. Still, Felicity Jones is good in it. Armie Hammer plays her husband, and he's fine. I find him a boring actor. But overall, I mean, it's a fine movie. It does seem to go through the motions. It's not like a super compelling film, but I mean, I'll watch anything with Felicity Jones in it. Even though, I mean, it's not like she's in a bikini or anything. That would have been nice, though. Because I am a pig. I'm sorry. Anyways, I'm going to have to say, On the Basis of Sex, kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Holmes and Watson here. Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly star as a bumbling pair of detectives in the Victorian era.
Sherlock Holmes. His methods are ingenious.
Right there.
He's a master of disguise.
What have you done with Sherlock?
Why, Watson?
I never left.
Oh, amazing.
And his mind is brilliant. Solve this case in 4 days or I will kill the Queen.
Signed, Professor James Moriarty.
Come, Watson. We have a killer to catch.
I can't even bring myself to say that they're the Sherlock Holmes, because, I mean, they make the story such an exercise in buffoonery. I don't even know how to conceptualize this. Like, my mother is a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes, and she gets enraged at, like, the Benedict Cumberbatch version of Sherlock Holmes, because he's not quite the same as what she read when she read Arthur Conan Doyle's works. But this one is just, this is just silly. I mean, it's like Sherlock Holmes' smarter brother with Gene Wilder and Marty Feldman and Madeline Kahn back in the 70s, which is a funny enough movie in its own right. This one, it's interesting. I did not get a chance to see it. They didn't screen it. I know several critics who actually went on Christmas Day to go see this because they're doing their jobs. I took the week off, but I wasn't going to go pay to see this one. Not when I had, stuff to do that involved sitting around and, not going to see movies. But this one has a notorious 0% on Rotten Tomatoes, at least the last time I checked. It may have, by the time you hear this, it may have had that one or two people who liked it throw out a review. But this movie is apparently total garbage. Everyone's hated it. It's like 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. A story came out this week that said that this film was originally, Sony tried to dump it onto Netflix. And even Netflix said, yeah, no way. We're going to take, you know, as many Adam Sandler movies as we possibly can, but not this little turd. So proceed with caution on this one. But I have to say, there's a part of me that now really, really wants to see it in a sort of morbid curiosity way, because I wonder, can it be that bad? Apparently it is. It gets a preempt to suck. It didn't get screened.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Vice and Destroyer. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Vice. Christian Bale stars as Vice President Dick Cheney in this story of how he got into politics and how his presence in the White House changed the political landscape.
I want you to be my VP. I want you. You're my vice.
The vice presidency is a mostly symbolic job.
Uh-huh.
However, if we came to a different understanding, I can handle the more mundane jobs. Overseeing bureaucracy, military, energy, and foreign policy.
I like that.
This is one that was definitely open wide on Christmas Day. So if you want to see this, you have had a couple days to do it. You can go check this out if you want to. The most important thing to mention about this film is Christian Bale's performance. Not just his performance, but also the makeup and the changes they put him through physically to look. I mean, he looks like Dick Cheney and he sounds like Dick Cheney. He has the cadence of the way Dick Cheney talks. I don't care where your political affiliations lie. This is the performance to beat this year. Just as Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill last year in The Darkest Hour was the performance to beat, this is this year's performance to beat. Mark my words, Christian Bale is going to win Best Actor for this movie. And he should. It's well deserved. He does a great job in it. He has the nuances of his responses, his tics, the way he breathes, the way he moves his head, you know, just everything about it. It's such a nuanced performance and a chameleon performance, especially as Cheney gets older in the film. When he's a younger man in Wyoming, you can see Christian Bale in there because he's a younger dude. But then they kind of have to take his hair off and, you know, put on the bald wig and then they, you know, get him gain some pounds and put some glasses on him. And he looks less and less like Batman and more like the Dick Cheney that most people knew. Most people didn't know who the heck Dick Cheney was before he became vice president of the United States under George W. Bush. I mean, yeah, he was involved in Washington for decades and he did everything, you know, CIA and all that kind of stuff. But most people didn't know who he was you wouldn't recognize him. And it wasn't until Dick Cheney became vice president. And most people can recognize who's the vice president. And same thing with Mike Pence. Nobody knows who Mike Pence was unless you lived in Indiana. You probably didn't know who Mike Pence was before he became Trump's vice president. And he probably felt the same way about Joe Al. Joe Biden was maybe a little more involved. But even then, Joe Biden was just a guy who knocked around the political junkies did. Leslie Knope knew who these people were. Average people didn't know who these folks were. Let's put that aside. Now let's talk about the movie. This is done by Adam McKay. It's the people who did The Big Short. And The Big Short was a brilliant movie. And the reason The Big Short was so good is because it was able to take the mess of the financial crisis and break it down and deconstruct it so an average person can understand it. And that was important because, you know, gave the average person a little bit more accessibility of knowing what the heck happened and how the economy got to the point that it did for that whole collapse and all the problems that we had. This is a little bit different because he's trying to encapsulate Dick Cheney's career. And Dick Cheney's had a big career in politics. Again, I don't care what your affiliations are politically, you cannot deny the fact that Dick Cheney has worked in multiple areas of government at different levels and in different positions, and he's left and come back. There's a lot of, this is a massive career for a person, and a lot of it people don't know. Like I said, people only really know Dick Cheney from his vice presidential years, but McKay tries to deconstruct and put all of this into a basket, kind of the way he did with The Big Short. But The Big Short, it all was relevant to this financial crisis. This is kind of a sprawling landscape of a political figure. So with that said, it gets complicated. There's a lot to work on. What he should have really done was go after him as vice president. But they spend so much time in the rest of his career, the ups and downs and this job and that job and how he got started, that it gets very crowded. I mean, it's a well-made movie, but it's very, very crowded. It's also very critical of him. I mean, let's face it, you know, nothing says Christmas like a scathing look at a former vice president. And even at the end of the movie, there's a little stinger at the end of the movie where he tries to address he sort of preemptively tries to address the whole, oh, this is just liberal garbage argument, but he's terrible at trying to address it. I think there is a way to address it, but it falls into almost a Facebook argument at the end. And he basically excuses anybody who wants to just throw this out as liberal propaganda. He basically gives him that card at the end. And he really should have either not answered that question at all and just let it be what it is, or he should have taken a better attempt at addressing that. And that's the big thing that's going to be the stickler with this movie is where you feel your politics lie. Because if you're a fan of Dick Cheney, you're going to be like, well, they cherry picked some of the worst moments and blew those up and then sort of ignored anything good that came of it. And if you hate Dick Cheney and you didn't like what he did, and you're going to be like, yeah, screw that guy, you know. So I don't think this accomplishes anything. I mean, The Big Short certainly accomplished stuff. This becomes overly complex, and it's really more for political wonks than anyone else, and it's going to preach to the choir or be rejected by the choir, one or the other. But still, it's an okay movie. It's worth checking out just for the buzz. So I'm going to say that Vice kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Destroyer. This is one that's opening. It's trickling out, so it may not be in your hometown, but it will be eventually. Nicole Kidman stars as a Los Angeles detective who got too involved in an undercover sting with drugs and must dig up other gang members years later to set things right.
Who is it?
No ID, no idea.
I know your whole story.
Placing our agent undercover, she'll look right enough next to our guy.
If we do this, we accept the consequences.
Yes.
You love me.
You know I do.
You chose to play cops and robbers. And you lost.
First of all, I know Nicole Kidman is getting all these accolades for this performance. It's the greatest performance of her life. It's just that you're not prepared for anything, blah, 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 blah. This movie's awful. I don't care how good of a performance. She does a good performance. She becomes this strung out, gritty character. And that's, I guess, commendable as an actor. I mean, this time of year, some character that's dealing with addiction and is strung out and looks terrible, that's nothing new. I mean, like I said earlier in the show, we've got Beautiful Boy and Ben Is Back are both these drug addict movies that you can deal with addiction and the struggles and the problems that it causes for families. I don't think that ground needs to be covered in this movie. Yes, it's a bit of a transformative performance. And yes, it's not Nicole Kidman looking beautiful. And no, she's not wearing a prosthetic nose like she did in The Hours. But it's still this sort of pretentious mess. It's nihilistic. And the characters, I hated all the characters, even the good guys. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. It jumps around, and it's a real sort of manic movie, and it's very nihilistic and awful, and all the characters just are awful to each other and to themselves. And even times when you should be feeling sympathy for someone, you can't even muster enough to feel sympathy. I just hated everyone in this movie. And then, of course, then I looked at it, oh, yeah, it's directed by Karen Kusama. And that's the person who gave us movies like Jennifer's Body and Aeon Flux, two of the worst movies of the last 15 years. Those movies are just downright awful and at times incoherent. Why do we keep giving this woman money to make movies? Because they are garbage. And Destroyer is one of those pieces of garbage. It thinks it's smarter than it is. It thinks it's more clever than it is. And it's not. It's the same old crap that we see on bad TV shows with dirty detectives that are struggling with problems on their own. It's just, it's awful. I've seen this a dozen times. And I that's why it's just awful. I can't stand this movie. This is such a chore to watch. I watched it. I took the hit for everybody else. You no longer have to go see this movie because I suffered through it for you. Destroyer totally sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Stan and Ollie, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Starman. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews with Stan and Ollie. Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly star as the classic comedy duo Laurel and Hardy as they embark on a British tour in the 50s to try to restart their careers.
Pretty empty last night.
I guess people just don't want to see Laurel and Hardy anymore.
Has he been pushing you a little too hard, babe?
You know, Stan.
You could have said goodbye, Oliver, a long time ago.
We had a good thing going when you had this big chip on your shoulder because I did a picture with someone else.
I couldn't sleep for days when they told me what you did. You got lucky because you met me.
Lucky to spend my life with a man who hides behind his typewriter?
One of the things I was worried about with this movie when I first was going to watch it, and it's funny because I mentioned that I bring my father over and I make him watch these award films. So we'll watch like some more fun stuff, like the Planet of the Apes movies in the new year. But I have to get through all these award movies. I'm like, sorry, Dad, you got to watch these. But I made him watch Dan and Ollie because I thought he might enjoy it because my dad was the one who introduced me to Laurel and Hardy. And I remember as a kid going up and visiting my grandparents in Cleveland, and there was this TV show Superhost, who was this guy. He was probably just a manager somewhere at the TV station. And he would dress up as a superhero, you know, like it just the cheesiest outfit. And they had Big Chuck and Little John also at night and stuff like that. So I remember watching that stuff as a kid, and they'd always show like Three Stooges and Laurel and Hardy shorts. And I loved Laurel and Hardy as a kid. I grew up completely adoring them. I like the Three Stooges too. Don't get me wrong. I love the Three Stooges. But there was something special about Laurel and Hardy. And the thing that I've always loved about those is even though they always like grumbled at each other, and of course that was kind of Oliver Hardy's thing, was to grumble and look annoyed, you could tell there was a real love there. And that's different than something like Abbott and Costello, where Bud Abbott and Lou Costello really did not like each other. Laurel and Hardy, they liked each other. You could tell in their pieces that they got along, even though there was consternation there. And I'm sure, and you know, during their career, there's going to be problems, but there was a real appreciation and love between the two of them. And I'm always nervous about movies like this because I don't want them to focus too much on the negative because yeah, everybody's a person. You know, even if you're a great guy, even if you're a wonderful person and just a fantastic human being, you're going to have your bad days and you're going to have your times when you're doing things that's inappropriate. Everybody has their sins and everybody fights, and you put somebody together and you tie their careers together as much as Laurel and Hardy did, and you can't break out of that. Yeah, you know, you're going to fight if you're too close. So I was afraid, and my father was afraid when he saw this, that that's what they were going to do, that it was just going to be them bickering and fighting all the time. And it's not. And in a charming way, it's not. I think it's important to say that because Laurel and Hardy did have their ups and downs, and they show them in this movie. They show where they fought and where they disagreed and where each one felt that they were contributing but were essential. But there was respect. There was mutual respect and an adoration for each other and a love of the material that they worked on. And that's, I think, the best part of this movie. Also, both Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly do fantastic jobs in these roles. Now, John C. Reilly's getting more attention. He got a Golden Globe nomination for this. Oddly enough, this is one of two movies this week that's opened with an ampersand in the middle. And this is like the Golden Raspberry Award's going to go to him for Holmes and Watson, and possibly an Oscar nomination is going to go to him for Stan and Ollie. But let's not forget Steve Coogan in this. He embraces and becomes Stan Laurel. And he is brilliant in that role. And he's very generous in that role, very much like Stan Laurel was himself in his comedy presentation. He allowed a lot of the pratfalls and the bigger stuff to be done by Oliver Hardy. And in a lot of ways, Steve Coogan's doing the same thing and getting less recognition. And that's a little bit sad, but it's a wonderful little movie. If you're a fan of the characters and if you're a fan of the actors, absolutely worth seeing. It shows the ups and downs, but it also shows that there's a certain degree of heart there. And that's what I would be looking for in a Laurel and Hardy biopic. So I'm going to have to say Stan and Ollie totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office. Last week, Aquaman, of course, won. Everyone knew that Aquaman was going to win. What's odd is it's the lowest grossing first weekend of any of the new DC cinematic universes. It only made $67.5 million. But I think it's going to have legs that are going to carry it on. And I'm not going to say it's going to be something like Wonder Woman. It could. But it's certainly going to be something like Batman versus Superman, because that one dropped off so quickly, but it's doing extremely well. It's also doing incredibly well overseas. By the time Christmas was over, it was like $500 million worldwide. That's really good. I mean, when you consider the fact that Batman versus Superman was like, what, $166 million? And it made basically half of its entire take domestically in that first weekend. Aquaman's going to have bigger legs. It's going to do better. It's got a nice run because there's not anything big in terms of similar movies that are going to cannibalize its audience. Now, other movies, Mary Poppins Return did pretty well. Bumblebee did okay. It's not a huge hit, and that's a shame because the Transformers movies were really circling the drain, and Bumblebee was kind of a sweet little film, and it would have been nice to see that do a little bit better. Second act did okay. I mean, what, like $6.5 million? And then Welcome to Marwen completely tanked. That movie has a reported budget of only $40 million, and it didn't even make $3 million over its pre-Christmas weekend. That is awful. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is on John Carpenter's Starman. We have a new Blu-ray from Shout Factory. John Carpenter directs Jeff Bridges in his Academy Award-nominated performance of an alien who comes to Earth at the invitation of the Voyager probe.
In 1977, Voyager 2 was launched into space to the outermost regions of the universe. It carried an invitation in all languages for alien life forms to visit our planet. Someone, somewhere, listened and accepted our invitation.
How much English do you understand?
I understand readings in 54 planet Earth languages.
What the hell ever happened to good manners? We invited him here!
What's interesting about this movie, and I remember when it came out, and John Carpenter at the time really was known, and he still is, but he was known as a horror movie director. And he had done stuff that wasn't horror movies, like Assault on Precinct 13 was not a horror movie. It was done in the 70s. It was more of an action crime movie. And he did science fiction stuff. I mean, Escape from New York is certainly a sci-fi movie, not at all a horror movie. It's sci-fi in action. And also Dark Star. It had horror elements, but it's arguably a science fiction movie. But the things he was most known for, the things that were highest on people's radar at the time, you, of course, had Halloween, which was a huge hit back in 1978. Then you had The Fog in, I think, 1980. And then you had The Thing, which is also science fiction, but definitely horror in terms of the blood and guts. So he was well known as a horror director. And then he came out and did this science fiction piece that didn't have any horror in it at all. And I even remember my mom, when we went to go see this back in, 1984, she was not wanting to see it because she's like, oh, I don't want to see grossness. And there's one scene where he's, because the alien clones, you see some gooiness going on there. But otherwise, it's a very straightforward science fiction piece. It's a road film. These weird little road films that were real big in the 70s and 80s of people going from point A to point B and on the run from the law. Everything from Smoking the Bandit to Starman, you know, that had the similar ideas and sort of tropes throughout. But Starman is a brilliant movie, and a lot of it's grounded in Jeff Bridges' performance. He is fantastic in it, well-deserving of the Academy Award nomination he got for this. This was the first one that really people were really looking at him closely as an actor. I mean, I know he'd had some hits and some respectable stuff before this, but this was one where people were like, oh my God, Jeff Bridges, wow, he really did something with what was normally would be like a B-movie, some sort of cheesy sci-fi film. It also has a very good message. It's a little bit demonstrative at times and has some straw men in there. But overall, Starman is a fantastic movie. And of course, it's on a Blu-ray from Shout Factory. And Shout Factory always puts it, especially for these collector's editions, they have tons of special features. I don't even have time to go into the special features that they have on this one. But for one of the better science fiction movies of the 80s, in terms of sort of like those run-of-the-mill, non-grand space opera movies like Star Trek and Star Wars, but a more grounded sci-fi movie, a speculative fiction piece, if you will. So I have to say, Starman, the collector's edition Blu-ray, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this week. I need to go. That's it for this year. I need to go. Next year, I'll be coming back with a new episode, and I'll review movies like Eli and Escape Room, and I'll give you my list of my worst movies of 2018. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.